You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. So pleased to be here with you today. Boy, it is incredible what's going on out there. Just a couple of quick recaps. In Japan, the Japanese government wants to restart a couple of the nukes. They've got all the nukes shut down. The whole country's operating without nuclear power right now. And there's thousands of people. Probably not now, because now it's getting into the middle of the night over there. But earlier today, there were thousands of people standing in front of the prime minister's home protesting, saying, don't start the nukes. I mean, their food is contaminated. Their air is contaminated. A good chunk of their country is contaminated and will be for a million years. The Japanese have figured out what's going on. 70% of the Japanese population says don't restart the nukes. Jeff Merkley here in the United States is warning his buddies, his Democratic buddies in Congress, just let the Bush tax cuts expire at the end of the year. That's what they're going to do. You don't have to do anything. Just wait. And then right after the first of the year, I mean, they expire on December 31st, so, you know, January 1st, you have the same setup you have right now, regardless of the outcome of the elections. Congress doesn't get sworn in for another week or so. So right after the first of the year, hold a lame duck session and say, okay, here's a tax deal for, a tax cut for the middle class and working people that'll keep their taxes where they are right now. We're just not going to extend the tax cut for, you know, millionaires and billionaires, and just dare the Republicans to vote against it. Meanwhile, Grover Norquist is just getting hysterical. So anyhow, that's going on. As Linda Lingle has bought her own TV channel. I'll tell you a little more about that later on. One of these right-wing front groups has listed a corporation as a member of its board of directors. This is Citizens United on steroids. So, you know, it's a pretty interesting day. I want to talk in our first hour. You know, everybody thinks liberals love taxes, but there's a really important tax that, in my opinion, should be either done away with or made progressive. And I want to talk to you about that in our first hour. In our second hour, we're going to talk about privatizing schooling. In my opinion, kids are not part of an assembly line. They're not a product. They shouldn't be part of the marketplace. Peter Ferrara disagrees with me. And in our third hour, we're going to get into why and how you're going to see the Republican Party change if they win the White House. And what does that mean for America? What does that mean for us? And how is that the fulfillment of a plan that was put into place back in the 1970s to build up the Republican Party and destroy the Democratic Party? And might it backfire? We're going to get into all that in our third hour. And of course, your calls and a lot of other news from the day. But this is of particular interest to me. There's an election going on right now in North Dakota. Today's election day. It's Tuesday. And what's on the ballot isn't what you'd expect. It's an amendment to the North Dakota Constitution to end altogether the property tax in that state. And I have to tell you, if I lived in North Dakota, I'd probably vote for it. Not because I'm some kind of anti-tax crazy, but because I have a very specific problem with the property tax. At the same time, on the other side of the Atlantic and the other side of this issue, there's interesting news out of Ireland this week. The Irish are considering starting a property tax, you know, a tax on land. This is something brand new for the Irish, although it has a long history here in the United States. A few years back, I was invited to Ireland to give a speech. On the way back to the airport, a very chatty cab driver asked me a startlingly simple question. How is it, he said, that you Americans aren't allowed to own land? I said, what are you talking about? You know, Louise and I at that point, we owned a home in Atlanta. The mortgage was even nearly paid off. He said, oh, well, it's really simple. He said, here in Ireland, I own my home, and the government can never take it away from me. But in America, you only rent your land from the government. And if you don't pay your property taxes, the government will take your land away and sell it to pay the rent, the taxes, to somebody else. Sell it to somebody else. At that time, there was no property tax in Ireland. If you lost your job, you kept your home. If you were wiped out by an illness or accident or any sort of disaster, whatever it may be, you kept your home. The government could never take it away from you. It was that way when our nation was founded as well. Property taxes were used in part to fund the American Revolution, but they were on all the property you owned. Your horses, your cows, your corn, even on slaves in the South, and on the value of your house, but usually not at all on your land. Land wasn't considered to have great value back then. And if there was a property tax on land, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, all those guys who owned a lot of land, they would have been out of business the next day. Because they were all just getting by on the... I mean, the reason why George Bush took the office of presidency when he was unanimously elected as president by the First Continental Congress was because he needed the job. He needed the paycheck. Anyhow, and by 1818, two generations after the American Revolution, Illinois became the first state to levy and equalize, that is, a standardized property tax on land across the entire state. By 1900, 33 states had done the same. As of today, every state basically owns your land and rents it to you, that rent being called a property tax. And if you don't pay your rent, you lose what you thought was your land. You could have a house and lot worth $100,000, and if you're $50 behind in your property taxes, they can seize it and auction it off. When Thomas Jefferson was president, his old friend, the Marquis de Lafayette, asked him to translate a book, on economics by a French economist who was named Desuet de Tracy. Jefferson translated it into English, sent the manuscript to Lafayette, begged him to keep it a secret. It's fascinating to read the correspondence around this. Because as a sitting president, he didn't want to be seen as interfering in economic and political debates in Europe. And this was an explosive book because it talked about taxation. But Jefferson went ahead and translated the book because it confirmed a lot of his previous thinking. First of all, Jefferson thought that poor people shouldn't pay any taxes and that the rich should pay a lot of taxes. In a 1784 letter to James Madison, he wrote, "Taxes should be proportioned to what may be annually spared by the individual." In other words, you can't afford to pay taxes, you shouldn't have to pay any. A year later, in 1785, he added his thoughts on taxes on property, which included real estate, in a follow-up letter to James Madison. He wrote, "Another means, listen to this very carefully. Before I read this to you, you know the difference between a linear progression and a geometric progression? You know, 1, 2, 3, 4, that's linear. Geometric is 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, right? Okay. This is Jefferson. "Another means of silently lessening the inequality of property is to exempt all from taxation below a certain point and to tax the higher portions of property in geometrical progression as they rise." So you make twice as much, you pay twice as much taxes. You make four times as much, you pay eight times as much taxes. You make eight times as much, you pay 16 times, if I'm tracking, whatever it may be. Anyhow, if the ban on, or 64, whatever. If the ban on property taxes in North Dakota fails today, as it almost certainly will, Jefferson's suggestion that if your income is below a certain point, you pay no taxes on property would be a great compromise, one that's followed right now by many of the nations of the world. Only have people pay property taxes when they have relatively high income or net worth, when they're pulling in so much cash out of our society that they can afford to give some of it back to the country that made them rich. Bottom line, it's wrong that in America you could lose your home, particularly a modest home, just because you lost your job or your health or your spouse. The tragic reality is that those three things account for most of the people who lost their homes. And while it's not always property taxes that push people over the edge to give up their homes, it happens way too often. I think we should suspend property taxes nationwide on anybody who's unemployed or has been financially wiped out. What do you think?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So property taxes, is this a fundamentally unfair tax? It's also it's not a progressive tax, it's a regressive tax.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up.
Yeah, that's always a good idea, and Teamsters are particularly good at that. Chuck Wobery is with us. He is the president of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters Local 215. Teamster.org is the website. And, Chuck, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for being with us. Tell us what's going on here at this lockout at Republic Services.
We, our members in Evansville, Indiana, were locked out on May the 8th. We have 80, which is 5 weeks ago today. We have 80 members that work at this facility. And what the lockout is about is the employer is trying to force our employees to withdraw from a pension and start into a 401k where they would make absolutely no contribution into that 401k unless the employee made some contribution. And our members aren't willing to do that, and they have seemed to take an offense to that we just don't roll over and agree with their program.
Yeah, well, increasingly in America, employers are taking those kind of positions. What? Employees? Rights? What? They want to talk to us? We can't have that. This is a kingdom. Who you know, didn't anybody tell them Ronald Reagan made it a kingdom? Pardon me, Chuck.
Sadly, you're exactly right.
Yeah. So how goes the Teamsters' response to this?
Well, we have, you know, it's obviously very difficult on our members' families. They're receiving out-of-work benefits, and they're still receiving their insurance benefits because they are in a multi-employer health and welfare fund as well as a multi-employer pension fund. So the company's not in a position to do what they like to do in strikes or lockouts where they send a letter that employees have no longer have health insurance and wreak additional havoc on families. But it's very difficult. We have received support from our local city council's passed a resolution encouraging Republic to end the lockout and bargain. Unfortunately, our mayor vetoed that, but the city council overrode his veto last night. We are trying to have some conversations with them through our pension fund. You know, a legitimate concern that any employer would have is on withdrawal liability. But this situation is one where the pension fund has told them that they could cap their withdrawal liability at its existing levels. And that's a major concern for employers, but it's one that can be dealt with, and they can continue participating in the fund. They've also offered a plan, what is called the hybrid methodology, which is really all for ERISA geeks, I would say, but it is a plan that has been approved by the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, and they have met with the higher-ups, some of the negotiators for the company, and explained that. Our pension fund representatives have done that, offered that as a solution. And both of those are legitimate solutions. But what this really, when you put a pencil to what they're proposing, this situation, what they're proposing now, it would save the company about $5 million over the next 3 years at the Evansville facility alone. And that, obviously, is what it really winds up always being about.
So it's all about they want to take more money out of the pockets of the workers and put it into the pockets of the CEOs.
They're currently contributing $170 per week into the pension fund under this. If the employees did the maximum, which is a 5%, and the employer would match the first 3%, 100%, the next 2%, 50%. So if you put in 5%, they'll put in 4. They would wind up putting in about $30 to $35 per week per employee versus $107.
Right.
So you're talking about...
So your employers are taking about $140 a week hit.
Absolutely.
And the company sees no problem with functionally reducing the income of your... Of their workers by $140 a week.
I'm sorry for interrupting. Are able with a straight face to say at the bargaining table, well, they're really doing this in the interest of the employees for their retirement security. and what they know is with most or many, about 50% of the employees offered a 401k won't take it, so they will be making zero contribution, and then these people will have no. Retirement whenever they get ready to retire.
Chuck, you know what we got to do? We got to repeal Taft-Hartley. I'm dead serious. In 1947, that was the cancer.
Yeah.
That was the beginning of the whole thing. We had 35% unionization in this country. More than 60% of all jobs were the equivalent of a good union job because unions set the floor. Mm-hmm. And Taft-Hartley came along, and that 2 years that the Republicans controlled the House and Senate. During the last 2 years of Harry Truman's administration, and the damage that they did. I mean, you know, they vetoed Harry Truman's single-payer health care program. They vetoed all of the provisions of his fair deal, the follow-on to the New Deal. And they passed Taft-Hartley, which said that states could become right-to-work-for-less states, and among other things. You know, blew a hole in the side of the Wagner Act, the National Labor Relations Act.
Right.
And then when Truman vetoed it, they overrode his veto.
Right.
And I think it's just tragic that all across America, working people don't know that. They don't, you know, they don't know that, or for example, that the first president of the United States to put an openly hostile person to labor in charge of the National Labor Relations Board was Ronald Reagan.
Absolutely. Absolutely, they don't understand. They don't. Some of that.
I mean, there's a history to this stuff. This isn't. This isn't just. You know. I mean. You know. We can talk about. You know. The bad behavior of Republic Services, and it's. I think fairly evident.
Sure.
But this is not happening in a vacuum. This is part of a concerted effort on the part of conservatives and corporatists in this country, and in many other countries as well. I mean, Maggie Thatcher really kicked this off 2 years before Ronald Reagan was elected in the UK. But this is a concerted effort to destroy the American middle class.
Well, and it's been very effective, sadly, as you watch the erosion of the middle class for the last 30 years. And you talk about the Reagan Board. Actually, when the year I started work for my local union was 1981, and the experience right around the time that the air traffic controllers were terminated. But one of the decisions that many people don't know about during the Reagan years was how they took away, like, the guards, and we had any number of people, the Brinks drivers, that lost their pensions and lost good contracts due to that sort of thing.
Yep, yeah. Ronald Reagan declared war on the middle class, and that war has not ended. Chuck, thanks for the great work you're doing. Keep it up. Good luck with you there.
Thank you.
Teamsters Local 215, Teamster.org.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So what do you think about property taxes? Do you agree with me that we should say, you know, if somebody's unemployed, they don't have to pay any property taxes? And if you're really rich, you have to pay more. Let's make it progressive. Okay, so here's my proposal. Pretty straightforward stuff. Let the homeowner with a modest home spend their entire life not paying property taxes. While people like Mitt Romney, who's so rich he hired a lobbyist to argue for a city zoning variation on his beachfront California mansion so he could build an elevator for his wife's second Cadillac in the garage, let people like that pay a graduated progressive property tax. We'll do it with income taxes. Why should property taxes be any different? You know, if your income goes to zero, so does your income tax. Why doesn't your property tax? I don't get it. What am I missing here? Mark in Chicago. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind?
How you doing?
Good.
I've traveled in Europe, you know, and I've known a lot of people from Europe, and my family's from over there and the whole bit, you know. But one thing I think is true is that because people there don't have to pay property taxes,
in some countries, it varies from country to country. And in some cases, it's a progressive tax. In some cases, there's a threshold for it. And in some cases, everybody pays property tax. But anyway, you continue.
Right. So where I have encountered that they don't pay it.
Right.
I think the people there have a sense of sovereignty. Like the government can't just push them around. You know, they have a sense of entitlement, and they have, the government can't just take the rug out from everybody like they can here. You know what I mean?
And you know why so many European countries don't have property taxes? Why Ireland right now this is a huge national debate. Ireland is voting on this weekend. On whether to start a property tax, and it's going to be 160 euros for everybody for the first year, and then the second year it starts being like American property taxes based on the value of their house, and it's probably going to be defeated. The reason why so many Europeans will have nothing to do with property taxes is because property taxes are a vestige of feudalism. They go back 1,000 years to when the king owned everything, including the land you were living on, and you paid rent for that land, which was called tax. You know, the Robin Hood used to bust the tax collectors, remember? So it's the last vestige of feudalism.
So I don't know why the libertarians don't get behind this. You know, why it's not going to make it, why it's not going to go over in North Dakota. This seems to be like just exactly what the libertarians should be about, you know?
You would think. You would think Republicans, you'd think Democrats, you'd think everybody would look at this and go, hey, wait a minute. Why, you know, property, why if I lose my job, should I lose my home? I don't get it. And it makes no sense. Mark, well said. Thank you very much. Bob in Clifton, Tennessee. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Well, hello, Tom. As an alternative, there was a county commissioner at a nearby county who suggested to me that property taxes be based upon the income produced from the property.
That makes a lot of sense.
So that location, location, location would, of course, bring the highest property tax. And a person's home, not being an income producer, would not be taxed, which would also preserve green bands around cities where farms were producing a small amount. Their property taxes would not go up because of a resale value of their property.
This is how it was done during Jefferson's time and during Washington's time, and it's the reason why Jefferson and Washington could keep their farms, even though they were so broke that George Washington literally had to take a job he didn't want as president of the United States in order to pay the costs of upkeep at Mount Vernon, and why he died in poverty, and why Jefferson died not just in poverty but bankrupt, was because there was a tax, a property tax they called it at that time, on what they produced. So if they had a bumper wheat crop that year or whatever, and they sold it, there was a tax on the revenue from that, but there was not a tax on actually the land that they owned. And because the land really essentially had no value, it was just all stolen from the Indians, and most of it wasn't even used. So,
and as demographics change, cities change, different parcels of property begin producing income, and they could be reassessed.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you, Bob. Bill wants to disagree with me in Crofton, Maryland. Hey, Bill, your disagreement is?
Hi, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
Hey, Tom, I work also in D.C., and I'm a, a government employee, and I believe that what I make as far as an income, and I purchased a home here in Crofton. What do you mean?
What you bought was the right to rent that land from the government. And if you don't pay that rent every year, the government will take it back from you. You cannot buy land in the United States. And because the home is not portable, you can't buy a home. Because if you fail to make your property tax payments, your rent payments on that land, and you say, okay, well, I'm going to take my home and put it on a, you know, jack it up and put it on a flatbed truck and haul it off, they will nail you for that too. So you didn't buy a home. You bought the right to rent a home from the government for the rest of your life.
So what's your solution?
My solution is to not have property taxes on people who can't afford to pay them. That if you've got a really good income and you can easily afford to pay the property tax, just like if you've got a really good income and you can afford to pay income taxes, we charge income taxes. You make $100,000 a year, you know, you pay 20% or 25% or whatever it is. I don't know. But, you know, I don't have the tax tables in front of me. But you pay income tax. If you work at Walmart and you only make $16,000 a year, you don't pay any income taxes because that's below the poverty level. Why should somebody who's below the poverty level be paying rent to the government on their home when they're not paying, income taxes on their income?
Well, they pay it through the rent, too, if someone was subsidized.
Well, there's a lot of expenses buried in the rent, and there's no way to extract that, although you could build that in, too. I mean, the earlier caller said base property tax on how much the property produces. So if somebody is renting an apartment here in Washington, D.C. that's $5,000 or $10,000 a month, which, by the way, is not uncommon in this city, then the landlord who owns that building, who's charging those incredibly high rents, is producing a lot of revenue. They're going to pay a lot of property tax on that. On the other hand, if somebody is renting a hovel, and the landlord isn't making that much money, the landlord doesn't pay that much in property taxes. That way you actually keep some of the mid-range and lower-range properties around, which, allows for a diversity of people.
Where do we generate the income for our local, state, and federal governments, though?
Well, I think that there should be, I think we should revisit what we did originally here in the United States back during the time of the founders, and that is have a tax on wealth. Annually, you add up your net worth and you pay 1% of it to the federal government. if it's over a certain amount. So if your net worth is over $300,000 a year, you know, you write a check for 1% of that. You write a check for $3,000. If it's over $1 million a year, you write a check for $10,000. If it's over $1 billion, you write a check for what would that be? $1 million, I guess.
Our property tax is a progressive tax.
No, it's not.
The bigger the home, the more you pay.
No, not
the
true.
More expensive
that's like saying that, you know, no,
pay.
No, it's not true.
It is.
It's proportional. It's not progressive.
You know, it is progressive. If someone owns a $1 million home, they pay more money in property taxes. What do they get? More services than I do.
It's a flat tax, though. They're paying the exact same rate.
The rate is the same, but they more.
So, but it's a flat tax.
You know, because they have a bigger home.
Property taxes are flat taxes, and flat taxes are not progressive. Flat taxes are either flat or regressive. And in the case of somebody who has no job and who has to pay a property tax, I'd say it's regressive.
Why am I responsible for everybody that has no job? I go to work every day. You go to work every day. Why are you responsible for everyone else?
That's the wrong question to ask. It's the wrong frame to put it in. I realize it's the frame that that rich people love for poor people and middle-class people to be making. You know, they want us thinking that way. But here's the frame to put it in. Here's the frame to put it in. Rather than what you just said, the frame to put it in should be, do we really want to live in a country where when you walk out the front door of your house, you're confronted with beggars? Do you?
I walk out of, I own an apartment in D.C., and there's homeless people all over there.
Yeah, because our social services aren't anything close to what they should be. But, you know, if you owned a home in Amsterdam or in Paris, you would not have that situation. And frankly, in the United States before 1980, you didn't have that situation before Reagan came along. And if you really want to put it on steroids, go to Bombay and walk out of a hotel.
Why doesn't everybody just move there?
To where?
To
Paris?
To Europe.
Well, they're trying to, actually. They're trying to. This is one of the big problems. This is one of the big problems that France has. This is why Le Pen and the right-wing party is exploding in Paris, in France right now, is because people from you know, Romania and Estonia and Latvia and Lithuania, you know, the what they call the periphery countries of the European Union, they all want, and they can now legally move to France. And France has all these poor immigrants, and they don't, and it's crashing their social safety systems. I mean, you know, I think this is one of the two huge mistakes of the European Union was basically saying, okay, no borders.
We have our southern border being overrun with illegals crashing our system too.
No, it's not because the border is open. It's because people can get jobs here. We actually, over the last couple of years, have had a net negative flow of people coming into the United States over the southern border. There's more people going south over that border right now than there are going north. And the reason why is because the jobs are drying up. Now, the jobs should have dried up a long time ago because, you know, when Reagan never should have stopped enforcing the criminal sanctions against employers who employ people who are not citizens. But Reagan stopped that. No president has started it since then. And so we've been saying that we have an illegal immigrant problem. No, we have an illegal immigration problem. But again, I ask the question, what kind of a society do you want to live in? And that's why I think we should have a tax on wealth rather than property.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program. Visit TomHartmann.com for audio and video archives.
And it should be a progressive tax. All of our taxes should be progressive taxes.
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about a science book.
This is, by the way, this was to mention that at the top of the hour, we're going to have a debate on how do we have good schools across the country. Peter Farrar is going to come on and tell us the Mitt Romney story that, we just need vouchers. That's all. Just privatize it. Bring in the for-profit corporations. They'll do a wonderful job like they're doing with higher education right now. Right. The highest delinquency rates, the highest default rates, the highest debt rates. But. Yeah, we'll do it for high schools, too. And in our third hour, I'm going to explain in detail what will happen if Mitt Romney is elected president. And it's not what you think. Guarantee you, it's not what you think. This is going to be a very thought-provoking hour, our third hour today. So But apropos of this, Harry in Minneapolis, listening on KTNF. Hey, Harry, what's up?
I generally agree with your principle, but since you and I have both lived in Westland, I was kind of wondering how this would work.
Westland, for our listeners who don't know, is one of the poorer suburbs on the southeast. On the west side of Detroit.
The name.
Yeah. Yep. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Pardon my interrupting you.
That's okay. What I was wondering is when you have a situation like you do with the city of Detroit proper, where you have like a million people over all those years that have moved away, and you have all this empty land, and you have very little options to make up for it beyond property tax type thing, how would that situation work with what you're proposing?
Well, I would submit to you that property taxes are contributing to the problems of Detroit. You've got people who have very, very low incomes who are trying to stage a renaissance, and there's actually some remarkable stuff going on in Detroit with worker-owned cooperatives and community gardens and urban farming, and I mean, there's just some really cool stuff. But people are hanging on by their fingernails because they may have an income of $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 a year, and they got to pay $2,000-$3,000 a year in property taxes just to keep their house. That's wrong. I would suggest that the costs that, you know, we're a big nation and we're a wealthy nation, that we need to be shifting more and more of these costs to either a statewide level or a federal level. And frankly, I think a federal level is makes a lot more sense because there are poor states. And we shouldn't punish people. Somebody shouldn't have to, you know, have a lousy education just because they happen to be born in West Virginia. Which is not to knock West Virginia. There's some really great parts of West Virginia, but it's a relatively poor state. Or Mississippi, which is the poorest state of the entire union. Somebody shouldn't be punished just because they happen to be born in Mississippi. And on the flip side of that, I don't know if you saw in the New York Times last weekend, I think it was, there was this long story. It might have been in the Times Magazine. I read it digitally, so I don't recall if it was the magazine or the paper. But it was about a local public school whose PTA raised $1.5 million because it's a school in a rather Tony neighborhood, you know, a rather upscale neighborhood. And so, you know, the parents were able to raise $1 million. You couldn't do that in the whole state of Mississippi with the PTAs. So let's some equalization of these things.
Yeah, that's what I wondered. I agree with you. I just wonder, like, where you would get the income to do Michigan or Detroit, because you have some Tony areas like the northern suburbs where that's the case, but it only seems to apply for that area. So
yeah, let's spread it around the state, or even spread it around nationally when necessary. This, by the way, was the idea of the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, our Housing and Urban Development, and the Department of Education. And that these departments would fill in the cracks for people who were, you know, who had the misfortune of being born in poor areas. And I think that that's an entirely reasonable and appropriate thing. The idea that we have to pay for local schools with a local property tax, all that means is that, you know, local schools in upscale areas are going to have nice schools. Local schools in poor areas are going to have poor schools. And that shouldn't be America. That, you know, we're a great nation. We're a wealthy nation. We shouldn't be, you know, doing it. This is so regressive. Henry, thank you very much thank you very much for the call. Well said. Jim in Camino, Washington. Do I have that right, Jim?
Camino,
listening on Talk 1090. So what's up?
I wanted to point out that you can lose your house not through disaster, but through just a rich neighbor coming in. Say
you're right.
Live in a neighborhood full of shacks, and you got your shack paid off. And we out here we call them Microsoft millionaires.
Yep.
They come in and build a mansion or two, and suddenly your property taxes go out. Then they try to soothe you by saying, "Well, but the value of your property is so much greater."
Yeah.
And, well, I want to live here. Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's called gentrification, is what you're describing.
Yeah.
And the primary way that gentrification drives poor people out of neighborhoods as rich people move in is the poor people can no longer afford the property taxes, which have gone up because of the increase in property values. And so this would then put a stop to gentrification, or at least it would put a stop to the to the pernicious aspect of it. You could still have mixed neighborhoods. Rich people could move into the neighborhood if they want, if they don't mind living next door to poor people, but the poor people are going to still hang out there. And hey, maybe that would be a good thing for our society. In fact, I would submit that it would be a very good thing for our society. Thank you very much. That's an excellent point. I appreciate it, Jim. Rick in Cathay, North Dakota. Rick, it's in your state where the election's happening.
Yep,
today.
And we're all for our property tax.
We have just a little less than a minute before the top of the hour here. So
we're
it's
all for it. It funds our schools, our county nurses, our volunteer fire departments, our police departments, county sheriffs and stuff.
Sure.
This is all about the western part of the state and the boom, and their property taxes went up. This is all what it's about.
Right.
So we're happy with them, and everybody I know is voting no. And
it's not going to pass because nobody's offering an alternative. But what if somebody had offered an alternative that said statewide there's going to be a wealth tax, and anybody who has a net wealth
No alternative was offered to us. You know, what do we do? We got to fund the things we got to fund.
Of course. Of course.
You know, so we're all against getting rid of it. You know, and then the number three, we vote no that too because that's trying to get religion into state.
Yeah. Oh, my. It's happening to you, too, huh? Okay, Rick, thanks a lot for the heads up and for the information and for the report from North Dakota. We'll be back. What should we do about our schools? How do we improve our schools now that Bush and Reagan's policies have failed so badly? What do we do? We'll discuss that with Peter Ferrar right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, this is incredible. Just very quickly, an amazing story out of Michigan, of course. The Republican Party. Gary Johnson, you know, is a Republican. He's in favor of decriminalizing pot. He's basically a libertarian. So he dropped out of the Republican Party, became a libertarian. He's running for president as a libertarian. And he'd be on the Michigan ballot, which would hurt Mitt Romney badly. But the Michigan Secretary of State says, no, he filed 3 minutes too late. 3 minutes. I kid you not. He filed at 4:03 and the deadline was at 4:00. Maybe he had to go to the bathroom on the way. I don't know what the deal was, but they're saying, no, you can't be on the ballot. So the libertarians in Michigan have found another guy named Gary Johnson down in Texas who, let me rephrase this. It's not that he filed too late. It's that he left the Republican Party 3 minutes too late. So they're saying he's still a Republican and therefore he can't be on the Libertarian ballot. So they found a guy down in Texas named Gary Johnson, who never ran as a Republican, who qualifies for the Michigan ballot as a Libertarian, and they're going to put him up so people can still vote for Gary Johnson. And they're going to try and get these two Gary Johnsons to campaign together. Amazing, huh? Anyhow, what do we do about our public education system? Mitt Romney has this blueprint, he says, for privatizing American education. He talked about this a couple days ago. I think we had a clip about this. Which one is that, Shane? Clip six. Okay, fire it away.
So as president, I'm going to give the parents of every low-income and special needs student the chance to choose where their child goes to school. For the first time in history, federal education funds will be linked to the student, so that parents can send their child to any public or charter school of their choice.
So there you go. It's, you know, vouchers for all of us. Peter Ferrara is with us. He is the director of entitlement and budget. Director of entitlement and budget at the at the Institute for Policy Innovation and author of America's Ticking Bankruptcy Bomb. Am I saying that right, Peter?
No, it's at the Hartman Institute first, and then it's entitlement and budget policy.
Okay. So you're the guy who's entitled.
No, I'm
sorry, bad joke.
I'm the guy who's going to free the people. I'm the guy in charge of power to the people. That's what my reforms involve.
All right. So, and you think that the people are not free, that, that this public education system that we've had in the United States for about 125 years, really, it's been operating in a big way. Horace Mann was quite active in the 1870s and the 1880s. It started in Massachusetts. It spread across the country by 1900. The entire 20th century, basically, that system should be replaced by something like what Maria Theresa did in Austria in the 1700s, a totally privatized system?
No, actually, what the reform involves is a massive shift of power from the government bureaucracy that runs the public schools to students and their families, to low-income students and their families, particularly benefiting African-American, Hispanic, and minority and poor students who, you know, the upper-income people today, they have school choice. They just move to whatever school district they want. They buy a house and whatever, or they send the kids to private schools. It's the African-American, Hispanics, the poor, the minorities that don't have school choice, then you shift the power from the bureaucracy to them, because then bureaucracy has to serve them, or they'll pick up and go to another school.
Well, it's nice to hear you're such a bleeding heart liberal, Peter, but here's the problem. Those families, you're saying you're giving them, you're going to empower families, individual families and students, and yet they don't have the ability to teach themselves. They don't run schools. You're not giving them power. You're giving them the opportunity to buy something. And the question is, what is it that they're buying and who are they buying it from? And what Mitt Romney wants to do and what you want to do is give them the you want to take money away from me to give to them so that they can buy something, a substandard product, from a corporation. And we're seeing this played large right now in the at the level of college. Where, you know, in fact, I was talking with a guy the other day who runs a private charity that helps military veterans. He's a veteran himself. In fact, he was a colonel when he retired. And he said, we've got these private schools, these private colleges that are acting like vultures. They are literally preying on GIs and people who are just getting out of the military. They're wiping them out. They're giving crappy educations to them. They're leaving them in huge amounts of debt. They're making all kinds of promises to them. And in many cases, by the time you get around to actually proving that they committed fraud, they've declared bankruptcy and started another company down the road.
Well, you don't quite understand how it works, because what this would do is give the power to the students and the families, because they're the ones who can choose what schools they go to, so the bureaucracy must serve them. Or
just like college now.
And bureaucracy will have to serve them, or they will take their money and they will leave and go to another school.
But, Peter, my point,
now,
we're already seeing this.
Okay, you just interview yourself, okay, and then you let me know.
No, we're already seeing this, Peter. We're seeing it right now. The GI Bill is giving money to GIs and saying, here, go find a college. And they're going to, you know, it's just like a voucher. It's just like what Mitt Romney's proposing. And what's happened is all these private corporations have come in, set up these fly-by-night schools. They're ripping off the students. They're creating, you know, for the first time in history, we've got $1 trillion in student debt. Is that what you want to happen to high school and junior high school students as well, in elementary school?
No, this doesn't involve any debt. This proposal doesn't involve any student debt. Now, see, Tom, you don't understand markets, which is why you can't analyze any issue, let alone this issue. But when you give the choice and the money,
sorry for my
deficiencies,
Peter.
When you give the money and the choice to the poor students, they're the ones who have the power. So now the bureaucracy must serve them, or else they will take their money and go somewhere else. So
how far would a family drive their kids to go somewhere else? You think that a family might drive them 50 miles, 70 miles, 300 miles?
Well, it depends on the family. Why don't you ask them? But maybe you could have some minority families on your show, and they can tell you how they, you know, whether
how they can afford to drive their kid 300 miles to the nearest big fancy white suburb.
Well, you know, that's transparently silly, so I'm not going to even bother.
No, it's not at all. What do you do if you live in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan that's largely poor?
Let me explain it to you. On the current system, if you go to your public school and you say, "Well, I don't like what you're doing here. I want you to change it," they say you're a nut. You know, you're the only one who's complaining. Get out of here. We know what's best for your kid. And you have no power at all.
That's not true. You have incredible power under Title X. You can sue school districts if they don't educate your kids.
Oh, so these poor kids, they can't drive to a new school. Their family can't drive them to a new school. But they can sue. They can sue the federal government. That's just great.
They do with some regularity. And what happens is that the school districts fix themselves. I mean, this has been going on since the 70s.
This is a better solution than asking African-American families, poor African-American families, to sue the government.
Peter, first of all, there's more poor white families in America than there are African-American. Let's not make this about race. And secondly,
it is about race, because I'll tell you why it's about race. The average African-American or Hispanic student performs at the same level in 12th grade that the average white student achieves in 8th grade. That's under your system, Tom. And that's why you're a fascist, because you don't want to free these people. to have a better system, to have more power, and to make their own choices.
I agree with you, Peter, that our school system, ever since Ronald Reagan became president, has been badly broken.
You're talking all the time on the show, you idiot.
We had
a point.
We had a great school system until Reagan, Peter.
Your foolish point is that if you give them a choice, the only thing they can do is drive 300 miles to a new school. And that was your...
You're going to give them a voucher, yeah.
I'll bet you that you can't find one family in America that does not have a choice in less than 300 miles. I'll bet you $1,000 right on the show. You got the money? Put the money where your stupid big mouth is. I'll bet you $1,000 right here that you cannot find one family in America that would not have a choice within 300, in less than 300 miles.
Peter, I'm just saying that before Ronald Reagan put Bill Bennett in charge of the education.
Your stupid mouth is or not big mouth?
No, I don't. I'm not going to bet $1,000 on anything,
yeah, okay,
frankly.
You know you're wrong. That's why you know you're wrong.
No, it's you know.
I know you're wrong, fascist. You don't want to give these poor families.
Peter, call me a socialist, please, not a fascist. Call me a socialist. I'm a democratic socialist.
You want to impose your system on them. You don't want to give them a
choice. I want well-funded schools.
That's the bottom line, Tom. You think you're smarter than everybody else, and you're more moral than
Can you name any country in the world, Peter, very quickly, where what you're proposing is working?
Vermont.
Any country.
Vermont is a state.
Vermont is not a country.
Yes, but Vermont is a state where they have school choice that it works better than your stupid system.
Okay, Peter Ferrara. Thank you, Peter.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The website, by the way, heartland.org or ipi.org. Peter, thanks for dropping by. Oh, Peter's gone. Peter had enough. We'll be right back.
Made in America.
Yeah, made in America. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And I grew up in Lansing, Michigan, went to Everett High School, went to Lansing Community College, went to Michigan State University. Well, that's in East Lansing, actually, but in the mayor of Lansing, Michigan, Mayor Virge Bernero is on the line with us, who also has roots in Lansing, surprisingly enough. And he's got this new mayorsforamerica. What is it, Virge?
Mayorsforamerica.com.
Thank you. Mayorsforamerica.com. Mayor Bernero, tell us about what you're doing.
Well, we're trying to use the power, what we call the power of patriotic purchasing. We're trying to harness that to create our own stimulus. This is something we think mayors can do. We met up here in Washington, a big group of mayors, and we're going to expand into an even bigger group of mayors. We're issuing a challenge to municipal leaders everywhere across the country to look first, buy local and buy American. Look first to buy American before you go overseas. And we think that this is could be a tremendous economic stimulus. Municipalities in the United States spend about $150 billion, that's billion with a B, on goods and services every year. And unfortunately, now a lot of that's going overseas. And we're talking about from small to big. We're talking about paper clips, pencils, paper, police cars, fire trucks, pieces of, you know, sewer piping, you name it. Municipalities buy a lot of goods. And if we can harness just even get an additional 10% of that shifted to domestic purchasing, we believe that we can create tens of thousands of jobs right here. So this is, you know, this isn't talking about spending new money. There are some ways I think we do need to spend some additional money. But this is just harnessing the money that we're already spending and directing it toward domestic purchasing. So we had a great launch today. I'm very excited about this. I'm looking forward to talking to mayors and township supervisors and county executives from all over the country. We are going to be pushing this and pushing it hard to grow it and create a stimulus here, a sustainable stimulus here in this country.
Have you turned this from concept to execution in Lansing, Michigan yet?
Well, you know, it's hard for yes and no. We've just begun, and I need to partner with mayors from all over because the idea, Tom, is the strength of this is that, you know, like the mayor of Kenosha just left, he had to grab a plane. But, you know, the idea is we already have a buy local ordinance in Lansing, so we had that. We will pay up to 5% more to keep the money in the local economy. But the idea is that for me to start treating Kenosha as my backyard. So when I say I'll buy local, Kenosha becomes local. Madison, Wisconsin, Indianapolis, and they look at Lansing as local. So if they don't make a product in their city, then they'll go to this network and see, we're going to create this internet purchasing network so that you can quickly ascertain if a certain product is made in this country. Because sometimes people will assume that they can't get it in America. I had this recently with the medallions for the marathon, and people said, I noticed they were made in China. And I said, don't we, you know, well, what's the deal? Oh, well, we couldn't get them here. well, wait a minute. I know that the medallions for the Special Olympics are made in America. You're telling me you couldn't go to that company? Oh, we didn't know about that. So a lot of times it's just, we ask mayors to look at the pledge on mayorsforamerica.com and take the pledge, and it says you'll look first, you'll try, you know, you'll at least price it. And then it's up to each community if they're willing to say we'll pay a little bit more. In our case, we're saying we'll pay up to 5% more because we believe if you keep it local, you're keeping money in the economy. It'll reverberate back and it'll pay dividends here locally and in this country.
Right. You'll eventually see that money coming back to you and increased in the tax base because you're revitalizing your local economy.
Absolutely. Tom, we want to fight this. You know, we feel like the American dream is under siege, and mayors are on the front lines. We feel it more than anybody. You know, when the industry is, I mean, in the last 10 years, we've lost another 30% of our manufacturing jobs. Over 5 million manufacturing jobs lost. We're not content just to sit idly by and see that happen. We want to do something now. And this is something that doesn't depend on an active Congress. You know, I appreciate what's being done in Washington. I appreciate what the president's tried to do. But this is something, we don't have to look to Washington. We don't have to look to Congress. We can do this. Mayors can do this right now. And by the way, individuals can too. I challenge your listeners who say, oh, no, I can't get a Made in America. I kind of look, but I can't find it. You know, go online. I buy my jeans now online from a U.S. company. I pay $30, and I get a good quality product. And there's a lot of products, and we should be rewarding those people who are creating jobs in America. And I say that you, especially when it comes to tax part, I challenge government leaders that if you're a township official or a village official, a city official, county official, if you're spending taxpayer dollars, you should be buying American goods and creating American jobs.
Yeah, absolutely. Are you, and your mayorsforamerica.com website, are you building a database that will be of value to individual mayors in cities around the country?
Exactly. Now, right now, you'll see it's just at the beginning. But believe me, we're going to grow this thing. And I look forward to checking back in with you, Tom, because we're also reaching out to manufacturers. I'll tell you this, that you talk about what was happening in Lansing, your hometown.
Yeah.
And we must have just missed each other. But can you imagine if we'd gotten together, what trouble we could have made?
Oh, man.
But, you know, the manufacturers, the business community in Lansing is excited about this, I got to tell you.
Yeah.
And so there will be some expense to building a database, and we're going to be looking for some foundation dollars. We're going to be probably having a business associate membership so that we can help build this database so that the community can quickly go online and see what's there, you know. And the other thing I think, Tom, I mean, the possibilities are endless once we get together. Once we get the mayors and the government officials to sign on to this, we can work together to create a demand for products, for production here in this country. You know, if I get a bunch of mayors together, a bunch of cities and counties, and we say we need a couple million staples or staplers, you know, maybe somebody will say, you know what, for that I could start making them here. You know, we've got mm-hmm. great tool and die shops all over this country.
My dad worked at Lansing Tool and Die Sinking for 40 years.
I mean, some of those are dying, and my dad, you know, retired from GM. But you know, look, they have a backbone of this country. And those small mom-and-pop shops, those medium-sized businesses, and too many of them, we've lost too many of them. But, you know, we can challenge the companies, whether big or small, to make it. I mean, if we need medallions or T-shirts for the Little League team, you know, we can always go to a company and say, you know what, we'd like to buy X number with all these different cities. You know, we could do it in volume and get a group discount. We might even get a better price and have startup companies in this country. But, you know, the point is we got to focus on it. For too long, we've accepted the fact, oh, well, you got to go overseas. Oh, well, no big deal. Made in Guatemala, made in Honduras, made in China. That's just the way it is. I say, Bill, we got to fight it. You want to create American jobs, you better be ready to fight for it.
Yeah. Man, I love your energy. Virge Brunero, the mayor of Lansing, Michigan, my hometown. The website is mayorsforamerica.com. And I wish you the very best, Mayor Brunero.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your support.
And please check in with us regularly on this. Let us know how it's going.
We miss you. You come back, I'll give you the keys to the
city. I get back every year. My brothers all live there. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So how do we do public education in the United States so that it works? And am I a fascist? Welcome back. So what do we do with our school system? And why did our schools work so well in the first half of our century? The first three quarters of our century, and basically until Reaganomics came along. Why was it that you could graduate from school and, you know, America produced the best engineers in the world. We produced some of the best musicians in the world, some of the best artists in the world, some of the best writers in the world. Some of the, fill in the blanks. All right, you pick a field. America was best at it because we had an incredibly good public education system that was built in large part by Franklin Roosevelt, building schools all over the country as part of the New Deal to put people back to work out of the Great Depression, and by Dwight Eisenhower as a way of stimulating the economy to pay down that 127% of GDP debt that was left over after World War II. So we had all these brand new schools. I mean, you know, I was a little kid in the 1960s. I went to a brand new school. I mean, they had just built it. How many of our kids today have that experience? State-of-the-art schools. Well, if they live in China, they do. If they live in Japan, they do. If they live in South Korea, they do. If they live in Germany, they do. If they live here? Ha! And the answer for conservatives? Oh, well, let some corporation build a school. Well, in fact, what usually happens, you look at these charter schools, what happens is they'll find a school that's not doing well and they'll buy it or they'll lease part of it, and then they run their little private school inside or where the public school used to be, except now they're making money. Teachers are making less, working harder, longer hours, school, the kids are not learning as well, but hey, the stockholders are doing just fine, thank you very much. So what do we do about this? How do we make this work? Pete in Roselle, Illinois. Hey, Pete, what's up?
Good afternoon, Tom. I just had a question and a comment for you about the voucher programs that everybody talks about.
Yeah.
I've never heard a dollar figure given. And the reason I asked that question is because about a year ago, I had a chance to talk to a vice principal and a principal of a rather prominent Catholic school in my area. And I asked them about it, and they both basically laughed at me, not at me, but laughed about it and said there's no way that the vouchers are ever going to be able to have enough money to go to their school anyway.
Right.
That it's basically a joke. And I've never heard a dollar figure given. I was just wondering if you knew
about that. Well, back about a decade or so ago when this thing really flared up, actually maybe longer than that, it was during the Clinton administration. And at that time, the cost of a public school education on average in the United States, as I recall, was around $5,600. And they were talking, and the Republicans were specifically proposing $2,000 vouchers. So,
right.
You know, that proposal was out. And what that meant was that if you're already wealthy enough to put $3,000 into your child's education, and those numbers have probably doubled now because of inflation. If you're wealthy enough to put $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 a year into your child's education, then the government is going to give you a couple $1,000 to ease the pain, as it were. But if you're poor, you know, good luck, Charlie. You know, finding a school that will take your kid, particularly in challenged areas, particularly in difficult areas where it's hard to get good teachers and there's a lack of good infrastructure and resources, and the kids are actually more expensive to teach. And you say, well, it's a really poor area. Yeah, it's more expensive to teach because they don't come in with the social capital. They don't come in with the intellectual capital that is acquired by growing up, by being born into and growing up in a middle class or upper middle class family. And the school has to make up for that, essentially. And you're not going to be able to do that with the cost of a voucher. Your point is very, very well made, Pete. Thank you very much for the call. Jeff in San Francisco. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
This is a teacher who I'm teaching a school that was a WPA program from Roosevelt in the 30s.
Wow.
Still standing.
The school building was built.
Well.
Yeah, great.
Yes. And, well, you know, as far as the education, why don't we go back to the Declaration of Independence? If all men are created equal, they should have equal education, I believe.
Well, Jefferson believed that. That's why he started the University of Virginia as a free college. And stipulated in his will that, well, he actually designed his own tombstone, that on his tombstone, it wouldn't say President of the United States twice. It would say instead that he was the author of the Virginia Declaration of Religious Liberty, that he was the author of the Declaration of Independence, and that he was the founder of the University of Virginia. He was more proud of starting a free school than he was of being President of the United States.
Well, that's my biggest pride, is my teaching for 14 years. And I think the voucher program is the front to take away unions. It's a good way
sure.
to screw the teachers.
Yep.
And back to one last thing about the Prop 13, when that came in effect in California, that's when everybody I talked to at school at the time said the schools went down.
Mm-hmm.
But got away with murder on that is these big corporations who have buildings are still paying 1978 property taxes.
That's right. All they have to do is not sell their business, and if somebody else wants to use their property, they lease it to them.
Yeah, Howard Jarvis got away with that, and they sold that. The Reagan Democrats really bought into that because their property taxes kept going on, but it was just a way for the corporations to make the money. So that was got Reagan going too.
Yep, you're absolutely right. Thank you, Jeff, and thank you for your service to your country. I mean that seriously. As a teacher, you are doing the real frontline work for the next generation of Americans.
Well, I think you're doing the best service. You should be nationwide.
We are.
I listen to you on the internet now instead of
but Jeff, thank you.
Regular station in San Francisco.
Yeah. Thank you
You'll be back. I hope, won't you?
I sure hope so. Yeah. Thank you very much for your kind words, Jeff. I appreciate it. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul. Thanks for listening to Talk 1090 there in Seattle. What's up?
You bet. Hi, Tom. I'm also a teacher, and I'd like to take your big mouth buddy up on his $1,000 bet. I need the money. I need it so bad I'd like to bet him $10,000.
Mitt Romney's $10,000.
Yeah. Well, I'll take the $10,000 either way, but you know, here's the question for him. So when you have a special needs student, are the private schools going to be required to buy some of the specialized equipment that would be required, for example, say if you are a blind student, I happen to be blind myself, a specialized Braille display monitor for a computer, which run about $5,000,
right,
as would be required by federal law of the public schools,
right,
or would these private schools just say, oh no? And so what would happen is, well, if you were a disabled or a special needs student, you just wouldn't choose that private school. Or any private school, since those costs would be so big. So what would happen is all of the special needs students would end up in the public school, which is now losing the tax base through these vouchers going out to somewhere else. So all of the disabled and special needs kids would end up in the public schools that are now going in the toilet.
Right.
So he's really not talking about anything except providing money to basically private corporations.
Yeah, and wealthy and giving wealthy individuals another tax break basically based on how many kids they have in school, and producing a ghettoization effect essentially.
Absolutely.
For the public schools.
If I may point out, just do a quick napkin math on what you're getting for your tax dollars. You know, it's about $10,000 a year to put a kid through the public schools.
Okay.
And you go to school 40 weeks, 10 months a year. That's $1,000 a month.
Mm-hmm.
That's $250 a week. And that's $50 a day. 6 hours of school, that's $8.33 an hour to send your kid to public school. You can't hire a babysitter or take a basket weaving class at the community center for that much. And of that $8.33, you know, they talk about how teachers make so much money.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if they make $30 an hour, let's say that's what they keep saying, well, that to me, you know, that's you have 30 kids in a class, that's like collecting $1 from each kid in your class to sit in my algebra class.
Right.
Now, if you don't have $1 to sit in my class, I don't see how they're going to do it cheaper in a private school. Now, if you have $8.33, I take $1 and give it to the teacher. That's $7.33 left over, which goes to facilities and administrative costs. The facilities like your football field, your track, your band, your performing arts theater.
Your classrooms.
And computers and all the stuff that you don't have in private schools because they're so resource poor.
Right.
Now, let's talk about your property taxes. Most people with a 1,500, 2,000 square foot house at most would pay about $4,000 in property taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you won't, only about 25% of your property tax goes to the public school, which means you're only paying $1,000 for this $10,000 worth of education.
Assuming you only have one kid.
Right, that's why you only have one kid, exactly.
Right.
And so since you're only paying 10% of that $8.33 an hour, you're paying 83 cents. You're not even covering the cost of the $1 an hour for the teacher.
Right. Right.
See?
But it's still too much for these conservatives, because the evil teachers are making too much, and the kids are hey, the kids are things that can make money for corporations.
That's right.
And that's the tragedy. And I, as I kept trying to tell Peter, we're seeing this played out right now in secondary education, post-secondary education. We're seeing it in these private colleges and these private trade schools and these private junior colleges that are springing up all over the country, and some of them even online, making all kinds of wild claims and promises to their students because they can use GI Bill money, or they can use VA loans, or they themselves are offering student loans, which cannot be discharged through bankruptcy. Nice little slick trick there that they got through Congress 3 years ago, 4 years ago, something like that. And as a consequence of that, these students are getting totally screwed. I don't know another word to describe it. Paul, thank you so much for the call, and thank you for your service to our nation and our kids. It's great to hear from you. I appreciate it. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So how do we fix our school? What? Vote out all the Republicans? How about that as a start? How does your diet affect your risk of developing cancer? And what are some of the most effective ways to protect yourself from cancer? And what do you do if you get a cancer diagnosis? Dr. Mitchell Gaynor, founder and president of Gaynor Integrative Oncology, joins me, Tom Hartman, for this week's Conversations with Great Minds. You can see it over at conversationswithgreatminds.com. And this Talk Radio News Service report is brought to you by the German Embassy, which wants you to know that Germany supports the European strategy to strengthen the euro through fiscal stability, solidarity, and growth. You can learn more online at germany.info. Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line with us. Hey, Bob, how you doing today?
Good. How are you doing, Tom?
Very well, thank you. What's up in the news?
Well, there's a lot of different things. The attack helicopters, it's been talked about by the White House now in the last hour. Russia is being accused of sending attack helicopters to Syria on top of all the problems that are out there. So that was just a brand-new revelation. Mm-hmm. The Giffords seat, Gabrielle Giffords seat, of course, Democrat Ron Barber looks like is headed to a win on that, which is good news, you know, for the Democrat side. And the other thing, the top thing of the day, this is Attorney General Day, I guess. I went from Issa in the House side, the chairman that's threatening to do a contempt, to a grilling on the Senate side of a different issue. Of course, it's over the leaks. The Attorney General has announced the appointment of two attorneys, U.S. attorneys, and one from Maryland, Tom, and one from D.C., to look into this. But John Cornyn, Senator Cornyn from Texas, called upon him to resign, of course, which, you know, He's head of the Senate Campaign Committee.
Right.
One would expect, I guess, he would do that. And then some said, well, this isn't enough. You need a special prosecutor. I got to tell you on an inside deal here, because I talked to colleagues both sides of the aisle, but Republican leadership is actually not real enthused with all this, because they think that some of the members are clouding the message. They want the president to, quote, fry in the economic news, and they think this is going to take away from that. So there's a little bit of internal food fight on the R side.
Oh, that's very interesting. And the thing that I find fascinating about this whole Fast and Furious thing is that if you talk to, you know, just walk up to people who don't watch Fox News and don't listen to right-wing talk radio, mm-hmm. which is the majority of Americans. I mean, you know, Fox News on a good day has 3 million viewers, and probably all of right-wing talk radio across America on a really, really good day might have 5 million. But if you talk to average Americans and say, what's Fast and Furious, they'll give you a totally blank stare. They have no idea what it is.
It's a movie.
Right. And if you ask the Republicans or conservatives, when did Fast and Furious start? They will not point out to you that it started during the George Bush administration.
Exactly. And it did. And plus, look, Attorney General Holder, by no stretch of the imagination, is not Alberto Gonzalez. So if the Republicans think they're going, you know, down that path where you've got an Attorney General that's going to sit there and say, I don't know, 72 times and shred the Constitution at will, which Alberto Gonzalez did and was, you know, a total pawn of the president, this isn't the same guy. Eric Holder is not Alberto Gonzalez. So that's they're trying to shoot fish in the wrong barrel.
Absolutely. So what else is going on in the world?
Well, that's the voting fight is escalating in Florida, of course, between the Justice Department and the state of Florida about purging people off the rolls on the local. The disturbing thing, I think, the Center for Constitutional Rights is pretty upset with the Supreme Court because they punted that Gitmo ball, Guantanamo Bay, right back to the D.C. Circuit Court, which is the country's most conservative court of appeals. So it looks like nothing further is happening on habeas corpus, and people are going to sit maybe another decade not knowing if or why they would be charged for something.
Can't anybody read the Bill of Rights?
Yeah, you know, it amazes me. You know, if you and I are in charge of something and we don't like somebody, we just send them to Gitmo. You know, we call it Gitmo, Guantanamo Bay. We send them there, and we just say, well, you know, you're a bad guy, and you're going to sit there for 15 years, and maybe we'll decide to charge you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just not due process. I mean, we just can't say everybody sitting there is guilty. And this thing just has taken a life of its own. Nothing budges on it, Tom.
Right, but the 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th Amendments of the Constitution explicitly lay out a process of due process, mm-hmm. that before you can be imprisoned for any period of time of consequence, there has to be a demonstration that you're guilty of something. And you are entitled to a trial by a jury of your peers.
And you're told something.
Yeah. And even under the rules of war, I mean, if you want to make the argument that these people are warriors who are captured on a battlefield, the battlefield is planet Earth, you know, however you want to stretch it, even under the rules of war, prisoners of war have certain rights. And we're not respecting those rights.
We had Nuremberg. As bad as we knew what the Nazis did, and bad as they were, and the horrible things, that, you know, they just didn't take them out back and shoot them. We had Nuremberg.
Had a
charge leveled.
Right. We held a trial for the bad guy. I mean, to think that these bad guys are worse than Hitler is silly, right? And the Hitler's bad guys got a trial. And so why shouldn't Bin Laden's bad guys get a trial? I don't get it. But anyhow, it's
back to a very conservative court.
Yeah. But I don't think even conservative means what it used to mean. I think that we're talking about just
individual liberty.
Wackadoodle court. What else is going on, Bob?
Well, there's a lot of economic talk. The big talk is about down 40%, but that's been going over since really about 2006 about the net worth of people. Mainly that's through the housing problems that are.
And that was mostly during the Bush administration.
Yeah, I was looking at the years. Right when this report came out, it looks like it's today. And now it goes through 2010, but it really starts around 2006.
Right.
So that's
the big fall in housing values really started in 2007.
Well, yeah, and some of the market was overheated, and some of it was overinflated. I mean, not that people shouldn't have full value, but that's the big part of it. The other news item, Tom, is about the insurers who maybe on purpose, I don't know, are taking the heat off the GOP about, quote, Obamacare.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the Republicans are pretty happy because three of the big health care insurance companies are about to give everybody some, quote, parts of Obamacare. And I don't know if they're doing that in anticipation or they're just doing it to satisfy some people. I wouldn't trust that they won't cherry pick when this whole thing's done.
Yeah, and what they give, they can take away, tomorrow morning. So Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Bob, for the report today.
Tom.
Great talking with you. This Talk Radio News Service brought to you by the German Embassy, which wants you to know that Germany supports the European strategy to strengthen the euro through fiscal stability, solidarity, and growth. You can learn more online at germany.info. Coming up next, what will happen to the United States if Mitt Romney is elected, particularly if there's a Republican House and Senate? It's not what you think, in my humble opinion. And I'm going to lay out for you what I think will happen. And I think I have some pretty solid evidence for it. And it's going to surprise you. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And we have seen over the last couple of weeks, arguably over the last few months, maybe even over the last year or so, some really interesting signs that when you add them all up, tell me something about the Republican Party that, to the best of my knowledge, nobody's talking about out loud. And I just wanted to share this with you. My thoughts on this, because just like back in late 2006, early 2007, when the housing market went in the tank, and I said, okay, the stock market's going to go too, look out. I could give you a long list of there's probably an equal list of things I predicted wrong, but I get things right from time to time. And I think I'm right on this one. For example, Jeb Bush comes out a couple days ago and says, you know, we really should be thinking about raising taxes. I mean, that wasn't his phrase. Those weren't his exact words, but it was words to that effect. You know, this whole Grover Norquist thing, this is crazy. Grover Norquist, of course, his head explodes. He goes nuts. In an interview with TPM, he's like, that's stupid, crazy. You know, I mean, he couldn't handle it. Poor Grover, you know. Oh, here he is. There he is. There. Oh, jeez. Poor Grover, you know, it's tough being a multimillionaire K Street lobbyist and having Republicans say, nah, not going to sign your pledge. Lindsey Graham came out yesterday and said we shouldn't be signing Grover's pledge. Really? Now, Lindsey's already signed it, and Grover says, hey, once you signed it, it's not an annual thing. You're mine forever. I'm serious. I'm not kidding. There's a bunch of members of Congress. I mean, like, you know, multiple ones and maybe into the dozen or dozens even. Republicans, of course, who are saying, this year I didn't sign his pledge. And he's saying, yeah, but you did last year, and it doesn't have an expiration date on it. And they're saying, take me off the list. And he's saying, no. You've got people leaving ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, that was founded by Paul Weyrich. Paul Weyrich, back in the 1970s, he founded ALEC in 76, as I recall. He's the guy who I constantly play the clip where he says, you know, we don't, you know, why do our Republicans have the goo-goo syndrome? Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by the majority of people. They never have been, and they never will be. In fact, quite candidly, our leverage in the election goes up as the voting populace goes down. That's it verbatim. I've heard it so many times I have it memorized. And ALEC is starting, you know, people are starting to get gun-shy about ALEC. There's a nonprofit just 2 days ago just lost its IRS tax exempt status because it was supporting Democratic candidates in ways that were partisan. And you can't do that if you're a charitable organization. Karl Rove, Bush's brain, Bush White House Karl Rove, is running the largest of the PACs and super PACs. And a piece of this is this giant nonprofit called Crossroads GPS or Crossroads something or other. He's got three or four of them, and I can never keep straight which one's the 501c3, which one's the 501c4, which one's the you know, the SPAC, which one's the super PAC. But he's aggregating hundreds of millions of dollars. And if he loses his tax-exempt status, if what happens to Republicans is what happened to Democrats, which you shouldn't bet on, but, you know, it's possible, then a lot of people are going to be really embarrassed because they're giving money to him through this nonprofit specifically so that their identities can be hidden. So what we're seeing, in my opinion right now, is a piling on, a get while the getting's good, that will be, if the, you know, the Republicans are really, really good at being the outside party, at being the ones not in power. They have all these stern proclamations about, you know, we need to cut spending and cut waste and reduce the size of the military. And, well, they don't talk about that so much, but, you know, cut this and cut that and stop taxing spending and borrowing and spending all that. But when they're governing, they govern like Keynesians. So, A, I think Jeb Bush is positioning himself for 2016 run. And frankly, I think Hillary Clinton may well be, or at least her husband is hoping she is. I don't think Joe Biden is going to run for president in 2016, frankly. Wouldn't that be interesting? Bush versus Clinton or Clinton versus Bush? But beyond that, if Mitt Romney were to win, it would be, in the largest macro sense, in the biggest sense, it would be an absolute disaster for this country because the most powerful institution in the United States is the Supreme Court. And there are going to be at least two and probably as many as four new Supreme Court members sometime over the next 5 years, and Mitt Romney, and certainly over the next 9 years. And if Mitt Romney was president, he could appoint them. And that could take us back to the Lochner Court. That could take us back to the court that you had before 1937, the court that declared, and you, by the way, you have people on the court right now who agree with the old Lochner Court, that declared that child labor laws were unconstitutional. They were an unconstitutional interference by the federal government in the right to contract. It declared that Social Security was unconstitutional. It was a form of taxation, an illegal form of taking from people. That Medicare is unconstitutional. That public schools with any federal funding whatsoever are unconstitutional. Now, these are all positions that are held by Ron Paul right now, passionately, and the libertarians. But they were once held by the United States Supreme Court. And they could be again if a Republican appoints a couple more right-wing wackadoodles to the Supreme Court. So that would be a really bad outcome for this country. We could see us, you could see us flip into third world fascistic status so fast because the Supreme Court is the most powerful branch. At the same time, though, my prediction is that if Romney were elected president and he had a Republican House and Senate, which is a possibility, given the kind of money these guys are raising, that they would just go back to Reaganomics. They would go back to, basically, I mean, Reagan spent wildly, or Bushonomics, George Bushonomics. Jim, cue up that clip of George W. Bush in his State of the Union address where he talked about he was going to pay off the debt. And I will play that after the break just as a way of pointing out how. Well, here it is right now. I'm going to wait until after the break because I want to lay this thing out right. George W. Bush came into office the same way Ronald Reagan came into office, saying we're going to cut spending, we're going to pay off the debt, we're going to be frugal. And then what did he do for the next 7 years? He did the exact same thing Ronald Reagan did for the next 7 years. Cut taxes on the rich. Borrowed massively. After 8 years of Mitt Romney, it wouldn't surprise me at all if our debt to GDP ratio was like Japan's, 200%. Borrowed massively and spent that money to stimulate the economy and blow another bubble. And then if it looks like if a Democrat gets power or if the Democrats take the House or the Senate at any point during that presidency, the bubble will pop and they'll try and blame it on the Democrats. This has become, the economy has become a pinata. You and I have become the contents of the pinata. The American middle class, working people in America have become the punching bag for the Republican Party. And they're using it to try and take down the Democratic Party. But my prediction is that if they get power, they will do exactly what they did during the Bush administration and during the Reagan administration. Turn this country hard right. Spend money like crazy. They will follow Jude Winiski's playbook. More on that when we come back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So what do you think we would expect if we had Republicans in charge? I mean, is it like all Gitmo all the time for all of us?
Tuesday.
Well, that's what it is. Back. Yeah, so what will happen if Romney is elected? Well, first of all, the Supreme Court will go hard right. You can kiss your civil liberties goodbye. You can kiss goodbye, say hello tort reform. In other words, kiss goodbye your right to sue if you're harmed by a corporation or a fat cat. Politics will become even more corrupt. And there will be massively more spending, even though he's not saying it, and it will be paid for by massively more borrowing because they know. I mean, right now, the federal deficit is really not a problem. As I realize as I'm saying that, all over the country, Republican heads are exploding. But the federal deficit is not a problem. If it was a problem, we'd be paying more than, 1.3% interest. Or more than 2% interest. We'd be paying, if our federal deficit was a problem, we'd be like Spain paying 7% interest. And we're not. The entire world looks at our treasuries, at our debt, and says, good investment. So nobody who's a serious economist, nobody who's a serious investor, I mean, if you actually believe in the so-called free market, if you believe in the Republican rhetoric, you have to know. You have to acknowledge. We don't have a debt problem. I mean, we might reach a point someday where we do, but right now we don't. And if we don't have a debt problem, then what do you do if you become a Republican? You run up more debt so that when a Democrat comes into office, you can scream about it. I'm serious. This has been the strategy since 1976. When Democrats are in office, scream about the debt. Republicans were actually screaming about the debt when Jimmy Carter was president, before Ronald Reagan ran it over $1 trillion. The national debt clock started back in the 60s or 70s. Scream about the debt when there's a Democrat in the White House. Spend like crazy and run up the debt when there's a Republican in the White House. So it might actually, you know, if Romney came in and he had a Republican Senate and House, the economy might actually look better for a couple of years because he would be spending like crazy. He'd be borrowing money and spending it. And he's already pretty much kind of dog whistle said this. But it will be a bubble. And the because we still haven't worked out this last crash, the great, what I would call the Reaganomics crash, which is the crash that started in 2006 when the housing bubble started to burst, went really big in 2007 when the housing market went in the tank, and then the contagion spread to the stock market and the banking industry in 2008 because they were so dependent upon real estate. That was a direct result of Reaganomics, of deregulation, of lower taxes on the rich, and of the banksters speculating like crazy, which was envisioned by Reaganomics. So expect more of that. And because we haven't yet worked, right now, Dodd-Frank was an attempt to prevent the crash from going any farther, to put the structural underpinnings back together. And what are the Republicans doing right now? They're trying to defund it. They have successfully defunded large parts of it. They're preventing the implementation of it. Obama had to appoint somebody to the head of one of the agencies created by Dodd-Frank during a recess appointment. Because the Republicans were saying, you can't even have anybody in the job. We don't want any regulation of the banksters. Let them get rich. They'll give us more campaign contributions. This is what the Republicans are all about. Getting rich, getting power, and then when the ceiling falls in, running. I always thought it was really interesting that the Republican donors allowed Obama to outspend McCain. And it's almost like they saw it coming, and they said, oh, let's blame it on him. Because as soon as Obama came into office, you had this meeting over at the caucus room restaurant here where these 14 Republicans sat down and said, okay, how do we sabotage the Obama presidency? This was on January 20th. I mentioned the last time I talked about this. I said, I don't know when he was inaugurated. He was inaugurated on January 20th. I was there. Here. Actually, over at the Capitol building. Two blocks from here. And the day that President Obama was elected, was sworn into office, this group of Republicans, and by the way, you might want to call these guys, Paul Ryan, Eric Cantor, Kevin McCarthy, if any of them represent you, or even if not, I mean, give them a call and just say, did you really sit in a meeting at the caucus room restaurant on January 20th, 2009, and plot the destruction of the Obama presidency by destroying the American middle class? Paul Ryan, Eric Cantor, Kevin McCarthy, Pete Sessions, Jeb Hensarling, Pete Hoekstra, Dan Lundgren, Senators Jim DeMint, John Kyle, Tom Coburn, John Ensign, and Bob Corker. And these guys sat in that meeting, and as Pete Sessions, one of the guys in that meeting, described later, they were going to, he said this in the National Journal, they were going to inflict on Obama a Taliban insurgency. And he didn't mean the Taliban, he meant the Republicans. He's a Taliban insurgency. We understand perhaps a little bit more because of the Taliban. And we need to understand that insurgency may be required when dealing with the other side being the Democrats. Congressman Pete Sessions, March 2009, National Journal. Representative Kevin McCarthy, we've got to challenge them on every single bill. We have got to show united and unyielding opposition to the president's economic policies. Pete Sessions goes on to say, if the Democrats do not give us those options of opportunities, then we will become insurgency. I think insurgency is a mindset and an attitude that we're going to have to search for and find ways to get our message out and be prepared to see things for what they are rather than trying to do something about them. In other words, we're hemorrhaging 700,000 jobs a month. Let's keep it that way and blame it on Obama. So Romney comes into office, expect an expansion followed by a crash. Get ready. Hang on. It's going to be Mr. Toad's wild ride.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And, you know, while 10-year-olds think Mr. Toad's wild ride is really cool, most of us grown-ups, no thanks. It's the good, the bad, and the very, very sesquipedaliously ugly, brought to you by the Organic Wine Company. Great organic wines. You can visit them at ecowine.com. The good. Germany. Last month, solar power systems in Germany produced 10% of total electricity consumption in that country. And on May 25th and 26th, Germany met one-third of its peak energy demand with solar power alone. Right now, there are more than 1 million solar power systems installed all across Germany, and solar system production is one of the fastest growing industries in that country. But Germany isn't just interested in solar power. The country uses other forms of renewable energy as well. And in 2011, 20% of all the electricity in Germany came from renewable energy technologies. It's about time politicians in Washington started following the German example and moved America away from our reliance on dirty and dangerous fossil fuels. The bad. Athens city officials. The economy isn't the only thing falling apart in Greece. So too is the healthcare system. According to the aid group Médecins Sans Frontières, I can't speak French, you know, Doctors Without Borders is what it is. In Greece, cases of HIV and AIDS in Athens have gone up by over 1,000% since 2010. The head of the group blames the increase on Athens city officials who have allegedly pursued a dangerous public health strategy that does little to fight the causes of HIV and AIDS and punishes those who are most at risk of developing it. The group also blames the increase in HIV patients on a suspension of a needle exchange program for IV drug users in Athens. These staggering figures are a reminder that AIDS is still a global epidemic and we need to be doing more, not less, to fight it. And the very, very ugly, Tony Perkins. Perkins, former guest on this show, head of the conservative and anti-gay rights Family Research Council, attacked the month of June for being Gay Pride Month. He somehow managed to compare America celebrating Gay Pride Month to America celebrating a drunkenness Pride Month or an adultery Pride Month. While this ridiculous and ignorant comparison speaks for itself, it's no surprise that Mr. Perkins is speaking out against Gay Pride Month. He wants to deny gays all equal rights and write them off as castaways in society. And that is very, very ugly. That's mind-bogglingly ugly. Okay, so what do you think will happen if Mitt Romney wins? You think I'm right? Wrong? Bruce thinks I'm wrong. Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Hey, Bruce.
Yeah, Tom, I think what they're going to do, if by some chance they do win, is they'll privatize everything big time, like they've been experimenting with.
Mm-hmm.
And if they take their foot off the chest of the economy, it's ready to rebound anyway.
Yes.
And it'll make it all a success.
Yeah, there's an enormous amount of pent-up demand right now, and it's not being met in large part because the Republicans are preventing policies that would allow that to go forward. So that's why I'm saying there would be a temporary economic recovery. But if they privatize everything, you know, that bubble will burst even faster, in my opinion.
Well, if they do it in the right way, they can keep it going for a long time and continue to accumulate assets. It's about grabbing all the assets.
Yeah, you're right. They did it over 30 years, starting with Reagan, but it really went on steroids with the Commodity Futures Modernization Act and the end of Glass-Steagall. Graham Leach Bliley back in 99 and 2000. And so that took 8 or 9 years, you know, to really for that bubble to pop. And that bubble got pretty big. So excellent point.
They're going to want to go after public assets this time around.
Yes, they will. You're absolutely right. They will strip us of everything. They will sell off every government building they can, every road they can, every water system they can. This is what they did with electric systems. I mean, most electric systems around the country before Reagan became president were locally owned, you know, municipalities, you know, cities, counties, and states owned most of the electrical systems in the country. Now they only own about half of them. And
they could even cut taxes under that scheme because, I mean, they can bring in as much cash as they want. I mean, they're just rolling in cash.
Right.
And if they have control of the Fed, they can print as much money as they want.
Yeah, that's my point. They will borrow like crazy and run up our debt. I said, you know,
they'll do it on a private sector basis, though, and make it look like switching away from government, away from the commons, is a good thing. They'll make it look like it's actually working in the meantime.
Well, this is what George Bush did in Iraq and Afghanistan with all these private contractors. You know, why pay a soldier $12,000 a year when you can pay a private contractor $250,000 a year and make a whole bunch of money for somebody who's going to make campaign contributions to you? No, I think you nailed part of it.
They don't need to impose a lot of pain on the American public to make it work at this point.
Over the short term.
They can actually make people feel good about it.
Over the short term.
Maybe for quite a while, as much as a decade,
but the structural stuff is still not there. We don't have manufacturing in the United States. It will crash. You mark my words. Bruce, thank you for the call. Howard in Miami, Florida. Hey, Howard, what's up?
I despair for the future of my country because I think after the 2012 elections, if Obama doesn't win, that we are permanently toast. You know, the Republicans, I think the perfect example of what's about to happen was in California when they had the vote on whether or not to raise their cigarette tax by 50 cents. And 6 weeks before the election, it was going to win by 2/3 vote.
Yep.
And
almost 70%.
Poured a fortune into it, advertising against it, and it lost.
Yeah. It's amazing what $50 million will buy.
Yeah. And, you know, when you figure it out, figure the Democrats, as inept as they are, could win 30 seats in the Senate every election, the Republicans could win 30. So there's 40 in play. So $50 million times 40 is $2 billion. The revenue for just Exxon was $450 billion. By the time you add up all of the profit for just the Fortune 500, it's $1 trillion or so. And
sure. What's
$2 billion? It's nothing. It's absolutely nothing.
So they don't name it, and they don't do it as openly as Mussolini did when he dissolved Parliament and replaced it with the Cameo de Fascistio Corporationes, the Chamber of the Fascist Corporations. And he said, instead of sending elected representatives, send the representative of the largest corporation in each congressional district or each parliamentary district. And the corporations, you know, became the government, basically. They won't do it quite that overtly, but I'll tell you, Rick Snyder's doing that in Michigan right now, for all practical purposes.
Well Gillespie and Art Pope in North Carolina, the Red Map strategy, what they did. The Red Map strategy is going to apply throughout the country, and that's going to be the end of it. That's what's going. That's why all of this relentless and just frothing at the mouth antipathy towards Obama, the white power structure that's been going on and running the country underneath the table was doing fine. It was crime-free enterprise while it was privatizing everything. So everything's going along nicely. And then the worst nightmare for the white power structure is the election of Barack Obama. If there could be anybody further down on the opposite side of the continuum than somebody like Barack Obama, and Barack Obama specifically, they couldn't imagine it.
Right.
And the first thing that he did proved their fears were justified when he did the Lilly Ledbetter Act.
Yes.
After the five Republicans said, oh, no, you know, you didn't find out about this suing 40 years ago when you were hired, so it's too late now.
Right.
And then he throws the banks out of the education loop.
Yep.
You know, according to the Times article, it was $68 billion over 10 years that the banks lost. And what does Romney's plan include? We're going to put the banks back in. That's free enterprise in America, as the Republicans see it.
Yeah.
Free enterprise is running the money through the corporations.
Yes, it's called fascism.
Right. And the other part is that we kill the education department because the uneducated people are much easier to control. And we turn as many news from the media as possible to Fox News because the combination of disinformation and poor education is all we need.
Yep. Yep. Sadly, I agree with everything you just said. Howard, thank you for the call. Mike in Lafayette, Indiana. Hey, Mike, your thoughts.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I wanted to...
It's a tough topic, though. It's a grim topic.
Yeah, it's pretty depressing. And I agree that...
Mike? Mike, I think we've lost you. The dangers of calling on a cell phone. Let's see here. Byron in Chicago. Hey, Byron, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to commend you. Preach, brother, preach. One of the things I always like to point out to people is that Cheney said the deficit does not matter.
Yep.
And these Republicans now are just frothing at the mouth about the deficit. And I think you hit the nail on the head with exactly what Romney's going to do. We'll have it. It will appear as though we're having a boom, but we will crash. So
yep.
You're right on the head.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much, Byron. I appreciate the call and the validation. Because I've seen this movie before. I'm old enough to remember the Reagan presidency. And that's what he did. And I think probably everybody listening and watching is probably old enough to remember the Bush presidency or the first year of the Bush presidency. I'm going to play a clip from that as soon as we come back from the break that, you know, lays out exactly what that strategy was. And I think we're just going to see it. You know, it's like what? Rinse, soak, wash, repeat. Soak, wash, soap. Lather, rinse, repeat. Thank you, Shane. So that's what it's going to be. It's going to be a very tough time for America. On the other hand, it could be the end of Republican hegemony, essentially, because it could be that they get outed for this. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So, you know, it could be that this is basically the end of the Republican Party, although I think it's going to take the bubble bursting to do it.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day.
50 months would be more than 4 years.
From the ashes of the king, democracy is coming to the USA.
You tell him, Leonard, welcome back. Hartman here with you. Okay, just to bolster my case, this is George W. Bush speaking to the nation. The Constitution requires the president to do a couple of things. One of them is that every year he must give a report to the nation on the State of the Union. So he got sworn in January, and in March, as I recall, he gave the State of the Union address, and, you know, just a couple of months later, and here's what George W. Bush had to say about the surplus. Remember the peace dividend, the end of the Soviet Union, all this kind of stuff? You know, peace dividend, we can break down the nukes, we can save money, we can reduce our military. This is what George W. Bush told us when he became president that he was going to do.
Many of you have talked about the need to pay down our national debt. I listened, and I agree. We owe it to our children and grandchildren to act now. And I hope you will join me to pay down $2 trillion in debt during the next 10 years. At the end of those 10 years, we'll have paid down all the debt that is available to retire. That is more debt repaid more quickly than has ever been repaid by any nation at any time in history.
At any time in history was the last words there. And that is, you know, that was possible because Bill Clinton put us on that course. Had Bush just kept things as they were, it would all be paid off. But then the Republicans sat down and said, George, that was a nice speech. And we talk like that when there's a Democrat in the White House. But you're a Republican, and you're in the White House, which means, let's see, page 12, Jude Wininsky's playbook, two Santa Claus theory. Oh, yes, Republican in the White House, spend like a drunken sailor, run up huge debt, don't mention debt, and hand it off because Democrats will be coming. So, there you go. Kirk in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Kirk. Kirk, what's up?
Hi, Tom.
What do you think is going to happen? If Romney, God forbid, was elected?
Well, yeah, I think what might is the key question, because he may not get the opportunity based on what's happening in Europe. I mean, I wanted to say that this is sort of relevant, but I think the president really inadvertently created a golden opportunity for himself to have his FDR economic royalist speech moment by saying that the private sector is doing fine, because I heard yesterday that J.P. Morgan Chase, one reason they're gambling is that they're sitting on a $340 billion surplus.
Yes. The president should have done, you know, when Romney said we need to fire cops and teachers, his, you know, John Sununu comes out and says, yes, that's what he meant. He's very wise. When Obama says the private sector is doing fine, he's walking it back the next day. He should have come out and said private sector is doing fine. He should have doubled down on it and tripled down on it, but he didn't.
I think he still has the opportunity to, and it all depends on the courage that he and David Axelrod have, because this very well may become, you know, like a depression election where he has to justify how he could be the steward to get us out of this in a better way than Mitt Romney, and it could go back to a 99% 1%.
But see, the Democrats are so busily trying to get the swing voters who are weak Republicans that now you've got, yesterday you had President Obama come out taking credit for cutting government spending. Which is fine. I understand politics and all that. But I would refer him to Harry Truman's comment that when the people are presented with a Democrat who behaves like or talks like a Republican versus a real Republican, they will choose the real Republican. And that should be a very, very cautionary tale. Thank you, Kirk, for the call. Mark in San Francisco. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Not much, but if this Ryan budget ever comes into fruition, we're in deep trouble.
Well, see, that's the thing. If Romney's elected and he has a Republican House and Senate, they will not pass the Ryan budget. They will not do it. It's just like when Ronald Reagan came in, he said, we're going to do all this austerity stuff. And what did he do? He borrowed and spent $3 trillion. George W. Bush came in. He said, we're going to do all this austerity stuff. You just heard the clip. We're going to pay off all of the national debt that can be paid off. All of it. And what did he do? He ran up, you know, a $1 trillion war in Afghanistan, put it on the country's credit card. He ran up a $1 trillion war in Iraq, put it on the country's credit card. Medicare drug program, $600 billion in profits to the pharmaceutical industry, put it on our credit card. The great crash, a tax cut worth, you know, well over $1 trillion. He added, you know, George W. Bush added $5 trillion to our debt. He doubled the national debt. It was the most that any president had ever done in history. And yet he had said he was going to do something different. So, this Paul Ryan budget and all this stuff, I think it's all just posturing. Peter Ferrara wants me to make bets. I don't bet. But if I were betting, that's how I would, you know, I would say, no, that's not going to happen. We'll see.
I think we should call all those congressmen that were there at the inaugural night that Obama was, gave his speech as president.
Right.
I think we should call them and call them out.
Yeah, I agree.
We should let them get away with it, Tom. That's probably the worst behavior we could ever imagine from our elected officials. It's horrible.
I am absolutely with you, Mark. And apropos of that, let me just wrap up this hour and today's program with the list of the members of Congress who were at that meeting. Should you like to call their offices and say, did you really sit in on a meeting at the Caucus Room Restaurant on January 20th, on inaugural date, January 20th, 2009, and decide to obstruct any efforts by the president to successfully pull us out of this economic disaster that Bush had put us into? Purely for political purposes. Paul Ryan, Eric Cantor, Kevin McCarthy, Pete Sessions, this is all according to Robert Draper's new book, Do Not Ask What Good We Do. Kevin McCarthy, Pete Sessions, Jeb Henserling, Pete Hoekstra, Dan Lundgren, those are all members of Congress. These are all Republicans, they're all men. And then from the Senate, Republicans, Jim DeMint, John Kyle, Tom Coburn, John Ensign, and Bob Corker. Now, also at the meeting were Frank Luntz and Newt Gingrich, who Newt Gingrich, when he left, he said, tonight we sowed the seeds of 2011. You know what he's talking about. So, anyhow, get out there, get active, share this with people, wake people up. Tag You're It. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.